Well, good morning. It is good to be here. It is a blessing to be speaking to you this morning, and it is certainly not the way we intended to start 2021, but nonetheless, I'm thankful. I'm thankful for those of you who have tuned in to this service. I'm thankful for those that I know are watching, not just here in Somerset, but also from various parts of Kentucky and even around the country. And it is easy for me to not be happy about our current circumstances. It's much harder for me to be patient. But that's what I am working on for this year, and I encourage you to take up the same challenge, that we know God is still in control. We know that an end to this disease could be in even the near future. And so let's keep that in our minds. And on this day, the Lord's Day, let's give our attention to Him and on His Word. There is a word in the Bibles that we don't tend to talk about very often, a word that I am excited to say much of our year will be focused on, and that is the word covenant. We don't use that word a whole lot. We don't talk about the covenants of the Bible, but we really should. And when we do, we tend to talk about the new covenant and the old covenant. But how often do we truly stop and think about what those words mean? And how often do we truly stop and think about how this makes up the very framework of the entire message of the Bible? I want to liken this idea of covenants to a skeletal structure, the structure of your body that holds up your muscles and your fingers, your toes. All of that is what the covenants of the Bible kind of make up. It's really easy for us to miss that God's plan of redemption is entirely built upon these covenants. What is God revealing to us as we consider this phrase that comes up many times in our Bible but is oftentimes easily overlooked? I think that as we spend time doing this, spend time looking into it, at least what I'm hoping to bring out of it, is immensely powerful lessons that reveal to us that our God of the Bible is a covenantal God. And what exactly does that mean? I think beginning with that question, we should ask ourselves today, what is a covenant? What is a covenant in the Bible, and what does that mean whenever we hear that word? So at its very core, there are many things we could say about covenants, but at its very core, what I hope that we take away from today's lesson is a covenant is a relationship. Certainly, you have probably heard in the past covenants being described as promises, covenants being described as agreements, and these descriptors are very true. But behind all of those promises and agreements is a relationship that's being entered into by two parties. And I think the reason we tend to sometimes shy away from that idea of being in a relationship with God is because of the many abuses that it is seen in our life. Whenever you talk to someone about God and they immediately throw up, well, I have a good relationship with Him, sometimes what follows is less than scriptural. They might say, well, whenever I am fishing or when I'm out in the woods, I feel closer to God. We have this relationship and I don't need what the church offers. I don't need what the Bible is saying because we have this relationship. People abuse things all the time, and that shouldn't cause us to fear those things. What it should cause us to do is say, I need to understand them better. We need to understand the relational aspects of God, because that's the way He is described. If you think about back through scriptures, God is described in relational terms. Sometimes He's described as a father. Other times He's described as a teacher. We even see Him pictured as a friend at times. But what about a partner? How often do we think about God as a partner? That is the relationship that is most often seen in covenants, the idea of a partner relationship with God. But it presents a unique problem, and that is, how can he be a partner with a big God? That's the great question that deserves our thought. And fortunately, Brother John has done some of that work for us already. If you think back to last week, he talked to us about how the beginning of the Bible brings up some foundational issues. Genesis is very important because it is foundational to our understanding of so many things. It shares with us the foundation of the world in creation. It shares with us the foundation of sin and the fall of man. We also see the foundations of things like love and grace and mercy. Our understanding of God is beginning to be formed by the very first words of the Bible. In the beginning, God. In the beginning, God did what? In the beginning, God created. God said, and things came into being in correspondence to what he said. We learn that he created the heavens and the earth. We learn that he created light, but we learn also that he creates life. And in that creation of life, he looks on all of his creation. He says it is good, but something stands out. Something stands above everything else in that life that he created. And that is, he created man. And man seems to be very different from the rest of creation. Consider some of the things that God says about this. In Genesis 1, verse 26, man is created and he is created in God's image. In fact, he is created to be the image bearer of God to his creation. And as if that wasn't awesome enough, man is also given rule over God's creation. So what we find in this foundational book of the Bible is from the very beginning, God created man. And he created them male and female. And he created them to rule over his creation and to share with it his image, to be his facsimile. But what does that mean? What does it mean to be made in the likeness of God? Well, if we take everything that we know about God out of the picture, if we take everything that we know, and we're approaching the Bible, from this standpoint, we're approaching it from brand new eyes. We've opened it up for the first time, and we've learned God created and God made, and everything that he made was good. What we learn right away is if man is to be in his image, man is to be a creator. And he is to be a creator of good things. As his image bearer, we should be doing that same thing that God was doing. Genesis 1 verse 28 carries with it that same idea. God, after making man, says, be fruitful and multiply. He's telling him, go and create what? More good, more things in my image. You've been made in the image of God, so go and make more things in the image of God. And so in a sense, here in Genesis, in the first chapter, we have God creating man and then inviting him into a partnership. I have made you. You are good. You are in my image. Now go and spread that image throughout the world. And yes, this is a picture of childbirth, and this is a picture of the family. But no, this is not limited to physically bringing other human beings into the world. In this sense, what we see is God offering man to be in a partnership to fill his creation with more good. He is offering man to partner with him. But we also see very soon that not only does he offer man to partner with him, he offers to bring in blessings, and he also demands obedience and with a threat of a curse. As we go on a little bit further, we see in Genesis 1:29, he's been saying that I have blessed you. We read that as we go on down through verse 28. But in verse 29, he says, I have given you every plant, every tree for food. And that again is reminded to us in chapter 2 in verse 9. God caused to grow every tree that is good for food. But he also grew two trees, the tree of life and the tree of knowledge of good and evil. And God places this stipulation upon man. He says, I have given you life. I have made you in my image. I have invited you into this partnership to fill my world with more things in my image, to fill my world with goodness. And I have given you everything you need. Just don't eat from the tree of knowledge of good and evil. If you do, you will surely die. Now, you might remember where the story goes from here. As you read along through Genesis, we remember that what happens next is man does eat that fruit. Man makes a decision that I want to be like God. I want to choose what is good and what is evil. I want to have the ability to do that. And in doing so, we have illustrated time and time again that we are unable to truly make that judgment, to truly choose what is right. And thus we have a picture that is being presented to us, a very foundational picture, the very feet of the skeleton of redemption, if you allow me. God creates man, God partners with man, and man rebels. And this is what will introduce to us the concept of covenants. This is what will introduce to us the concept of being in a relationship with God through this idea of a partnership. And in that, we will find five major times where God introduces this idea again, and he involves himself once again in the lives of man through these covenant partner relationships. Now, I say that five major times because there are also some minor times that we will be looking at. And I say minor not because they are less significant, but because they receive less attention in the scriptures, nonetheless, they still have a great impact in the lives of those that we can see them in, and also in our own lives as well. So I hope to consider them this year as we go along. These five major covenants that we will be considering over the course of this year will begin with God's covenant with Noah, in which God promises never again to destroy the earth in the manner which he had in the flood. Following that up, we find God entering into this covenant with Abraham, in which God promises to grow a family out of his seed into a nation with a great land in which the whole world would receive a blessing. As we continue down through history, we find God once again involving himself in a covenant with Israel, this time through a mediator, through this man, Moses, in which God, after rescuing Israel from Egyptian slavery, and then he enters into what can only be described as this kingdom, vassal kingdom relationship. And it's very clear in the stipulations that he, Yahweh, will be their God, and they, Israel, will be his people. And then as we move along, we'll also see that David is going to be in this covenant with God, where God will establish him not only as king, but also the beginning of a kingly lineage. Many kings will come from him, eventually one that will bring about the fulfillment of these covenants to Abraham and Israel. And in that covenant, in the Davidic covenant, we're also going to be introduced to this new Hebrew phrase. And it's not really new, but it becomes of great emphasis during the days of Abraham. Again, Brother John has done a good job introducing us to this phrase. It is the phrase Hesed. It will play a huge, huge part, and it is most often displayed in the words or the phrase steadfast love or loving kindness. But finally, we will wrap this year up with a look at the final covenant that we see in the Bible, the covenant of Christ, and the way that not only his covenant fulfills all covenants, but the way also it affects our lives, our friendships, our marriages, our responsibility towards God, our responsibility towards the church. And so we will be looking at many things. And what I hope you find in this is that there is great excitement in these covenants. It is an exciting thing that is happening. The God of heaven and earth is stepping into the lives of man to join with them, to partner with them. There is great excitement. And I hope that fuels your study this year as you consider these covenants of God. But for today, I want to very, very much an introductory look at this idea of what are covenants. And I really want to begin with a certain aspect of them, and that is covenants fall into two categories, conditional versus unconditional. This is what often comes to my mind. When I think about covenants, I think about the stipulations of the covenant. Is there conditions that they are built upon? And there are many other things that can be considered, things that we will not dive into in this introductory lesson, but there are the important factors such as the preamble of the covenant, which tells us who are the parties involved, who all is entering into this covenant. There is a background in the covenants that relate how these two parties are connected. What is it that ties them together? There are witnesses and there are blessings and cursings or curses which fall upon the covenant depending upon the status of those two parties. And then there is even an oath that is taken to ratify, to swear in the covenant. And most often that is depicted by blood sacrifice. But again, for me, most often when I think about the covenants, my mind is drawn to this idea of their stipulations. What requirements are there built into the covenant to show that it is still in existence, to show that it is still in power? When you hear the terms, this covenant was conditional versus this covenant was unconditional, do you understand what those words mean? First off, what I think we should learn today is there is a difference. There is definitely a difference. There is such a thing as a conditional covenant and such a thing as an unconditional covenant. But I feel that by taking the covenants of God and dividing those into these two parties, these two groups, sometimes we miss out on an extremely important point. An important point about God and His covenants that if we fail to see this underlying truth, we fail to see one of the most important aspects of every covenant. That underlying truth is every single covenant is built upon conditions. In this sense that every covenant is built upon conditions, one might even go as far to say that there's no such thing then as an unconditional covenant. Now, I can't see you all looking around at each other with raised eyebrows going, "I remember Noah," so I'll just have to imagine that. I want to caution you, just hang with me. Noah's covenant certainly falls in this realm of unconditional, but let's move through it and see why this claim, every covenant is built upon conditions, is true. What I want to do is, in the course of this year, go through every one of these covenants specifically. But for just today, let's go through them very briefly. And let's begin a little bit out of order. Turn your Bibles over to Exodus chapter 19. In Exodus 19, we hear about God and His covenant with the children of Israel. I'm going to put it up on the board. Exodus 19, and we're going to be reading from verse 5. And we're actually going to begin towards the middle of that verse. Exodus 19, verse 5 says, "Then you shall be my own possession among all the peoples, for the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the sons of Israel." That sounds very straightforward. It sounds very to the point. God is telling the children of Israel, "You are going to belong to me." But if we turn back just a little bit to the beginning of that verse and read all of it, we find, "Now then, if you indeed obey my voice, if you keep my covenant," God was requiring something in this covenant with Israel. He was saying, he was showing us a stipulation. You have to obey my voice. You have to keep my covenant. If they remain faithful to God and to His covenant, they would remain in the status that He is talking about. But if they were unfaithful, the covenant would be broken. They would no longer be His holy nation, His holy people. In fact, during the second giving of the law in Deuteronomy, God specifically has them reminded of this in chapters 28 and 29. Deuteronomy 28 and 29 is all about the shouting of blessings and cursings and the link of them to obedience and disobedience respectively. Because of these things, because we see that in this covenant with Israel, God hinges it upon their obedience, we look at what we call the Mosaic covenant and say it was conditional. There were conditions set upon it. Comparatively, though, we could go back to Genesis and look at the Noahic covenant. In this one, God says, I will never again cut off, all flesh with the water of the flood. And there's no if statements around this one. There's no, unless you violate certain commands, unless you do this thing or that thing, then I'm going to bring the flood back. He just flat out says, simply, I will not do this. Thus, we say this is an unconditional covenant. And that's the basis for these statements. The covenant entered into by God and His partner in that covenant is either based upon certain stipulations in which it is conditional to them keeping those stipulations, or it is unconditionally, God will ensure this covenant remains. Now, what I want to suggest this morning is I am not saying that every covenant had conditions like we saw in the Mosaic covenant. That's not what I'm saying this morning. See, that's what makes this covenant right here with God so beautiful, or with Noah so beautiful. It is a covenant with unconditional grace. What does he say to them? He says, I'm going to do this, and that's that. I'm not going to wipe out the earth again with a flood, and that's that. And in saying that, God still knows something about this people, and that is the eight people that came on that ark are the eight people that got off the ark. And they are a representation of mankind that certainly was faithful. We see that in Noah, that he was faithful, he found favor with God, but they're still fallen. They still remain unredeemed. His plan for redemption is still needed. They will continue in evil, and we will see that as we read through the Bible. And that's what makes this covenant so amazing, because God knows this. He's not surprised later on when we get to other accounts where they continue in wickedness. God's not surprised in that, but he makes this covenant anyway. And he says this covenant will stand no matter what. It's what makes an unconditional covenant so amazing. I'm not arguing against that this morning. But what I'm asking is, what are the conditions for the unconditional covenant which God created? The conditions were a fallen and wicked world. Look around at the condition of life on earth in the days of Noah. Genesis 6 tells us man began to multiply. Isn't that what God asked us to do? But yet he commanded in the garden, be fruitful and multiply. He was talking about his image. He was talking about multiplying what he had created, what is good. But what you find in Genesis is they began to multiply, and the wickedness of man was what was filling the earth. Every thought of his heart was only evil continually. It even goes as far as to tell us God, our great creator, became sorry that he had made man and that Noah alone found favor. But even that did not preserve Noah. As we read through that account, God comes to Noah and he uses a very specific term. He says, God tells him the end of all flesh has come. Not the end of Noah, everybody but you and your family. Not the end of everybody but you. The end of all flesh. That includes Noah. God came and said, I'm destroying everything, but I'm going to provide a means in which you can be preserved. I'm going to provide a means in which mankind, in which life can carry on. And it's going to come through Noah, if only you will trust in me and you will obey me. It is after the flood. It is after Noah follows the word of God, the death of all mankind, save for Noah and his family. It is after this that God enters into this new covenant partnership with Noah. Now, what does all that mean? What it means is that unconditional covenant which God entered into with Noah was built upon certain conditions. Conditions which illustrate man was undeserving to be in a covenant with God at all. We did not deserve God saying, I will never wipe out the earth again with a flood. Because in all honesty, man did not deserve to survive the flood. Notice the conditional covenant that God made with Israel was the same way. If you remember back in Exodus chapter 19, verse 4 said what God had done. He said, I had rescued you from the Egyptians. He said, I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Again, even a conditional covenant, no surprise, is built upon previous conditions, which these conditions here illustrated that the people themselves were unable. They were in a situation where they could do nothing apart from God, and they could do nothing to prove themselves worthy to God. They hadn't shown God that they were this great nation that was worthy of being taken out of here. They were simply a slave race. They were eternally indebted to Egypt, but in their mind, that they had no hope of ever leaving this situation. And at that time, God stepped in, he rescued, and he partnered with them. This is what I want you to come away with from today's very much introductory lesson. And that is, covenants are all about a partnered relationship with God to bring about his will of redemptively blessing mankind. These covenants sometimes have conditions placed upon them. These sometimes tell us whether or not the covenant is going to be dissolved or whether it's going to be upheld. And yet there are other times when they are completely unconditional, that God will be faithful in his covenant no matter what man does. But behind each and every covenant, there is a condition. And again, these conditions, they tell us something about our God. They tell us that our God is a merciful, our God is a gracious, our God is a loving God. What is first seen in Adam in the garden, what is fully realized later with the second Adam, Christ on the cross, is over and over again telling us our God is a covenantal God of mercy. He is the Lord of lords. He is the King of kings. And all of that is going to be depicted, is going to be shown brightly through his covenantal relationships with his people. Now, as we begin to wrap this introductory lesson up, I want to leave you with some pictures of how that looked through life. Every covenant that God made with man, especially the covenants that God made with the descendants of Abraham, were ultimately rebelled against. In the whether it be with Noah, whether it be with Abraham, with Israel through Moses, or with David, we see problems arising, usually very soon after the covenant. Noah was told, just like Adam and Eve, be fruitful and multiply. Again, we're starting over, and you go out and you fill the world with my image. But soon after that, we find him drunken in this terrible, terrible situation that occurs between him and his son Ham. The Israelites are told to live. We're given a law from God, a law given to Moses, which chiefly illustrated that you're going to go into this land that I'm giving you and you're going to have no other God but me. But over and over again, we see that when they went into the land, they took other gods, the gods of the land. Or what about the covenant with David? The covenant of David is marked over and over again by faithfulness, or faithlessness, I should say. His children, his sons go on, and they are constantly turning away from God, turning to not only the gods of the land, but to the peoples of other lands. They are in rebellion over and over again, and man is showing his ability to not be faithful to God's covenants. And that brings us to Christ. And Christ, in him we see a covenant which restores these promises, the blessings that were given to Abraham of a family, the promises given to Israel of a nation, and the covenant with David of a kingdom. All of this is restored and seen and fulfilled in Christ. And one thing that stands out specifically in the New Testament about his covenant is that it is certainly built on conditions. Now, we might turn to the book of Hebrews. In Hebrews chapter 3, we might turn there and look at some of these stipulations, some of these things that we might look at as conditions of this covenant. Hebrews chapter 3, verses 5 and 6. Talks about remaining in hope. It says, starting verse 5, now Moses was faithful in all his house as a servant for a testimony of those things which were to be spoken later, but Christ was faithful as a son over his house, whose house we are, if we hold fast our confidence and the boast of our hope firm unto the end. We see here a stipulation where is our confidence? Where is our hope going to lie? Is it going to be, are we going to contrast the people of Israel and the kings of that followed in lineage of David that looked to the world and looked to themselves for that confidence and hope? Are we going to be like Christ and be faithful over this house that we now are a part of through him, having hope and confidence placed in God? In chapter 4, verse 11, he goes on, again, making a contrast or a comparison even, to those of the Old Testament, saying, therefore, let us be diligent to enter that rest so that no one will fall through following the same example of disobedience. We are in a new covenant with Christ, a covenant that fulfills the old covenants that God has made, bringing them to completion in Him. And the stipulation is we need to be obedient to that covenant. That covenant needs to have an effect on our lives and the way that we live. We must live covenantally with God. I really look forward to seeing what that how that plays out in our lives more throughout this year. But I really actually want to take a step back to our previous thought that even a conditional covenant is built upon other conditions. What are the true conditions? What are the true conditions of Christ, who, if you'll remember, came into the world to introduce this unfailing covenant at a time of utmost failure? Remember, the covenants with Abraham and Israel and David, they've all crumbled because of disobedience, because people have turned their hearts so far away from God. And it's at this time that Paul, the author to the book of Romans, tells us God sent his son, Jesus. And consider what he says in chapter 5. For while we were still helpless, at the right time Christ died for the ungodly. For one will hardly die for a righteous man, though perhaps for the good man someone would dare even to die. But God demonstrates his love towards us. But God demonstrates his love towards us. And now while we were yet sinners, Christ died for us. For if while we were enemies, we were reconciled to God through the death of his son, much more, having been reconciled, we shall be saved by his life. What is the most significant condition of the covenant of Christ? It's actually not you or me. The most significant condition is the man, Jesus, who actually was God, who died on the cross while we were sinners, who was raised to life, and who, through whose life we find salvation. And under this new covenant, which is detailed over and over again in our New Testaments of our Bibles, we're seeing that it's his life that changes everything for us. And in his life, God demonstrated his own love. And when you read that, whether you put a mark in your Bibles or you just subconsciously, I want you to insert the word his own hesed. God illustrates, demonstrates his steadfastness, his loving kindness, his long-suffering, merciful, gracious, covenantal love. That is God's covenantal love and mercy. That is his hesed. What began in the garden with God partnering with his creation to fill his world with his image, what was destroyed through our rebellion is brought to fulfillment in Christ. And the good news of the gospel is it can be fulfilled in you. This year, in fact, this very day, we have another opportunity provided to us by God, not just to live, not just to make goals for the next 365 days. We have an opportunity with God to be in a partnership. We have an opportunity to pick up what he originally began in the garden, fill my world with my image. Fill the world around us with his goodness and his righteousness. What was begun in creation, what is more vividly seen in Jesus Christ. I look forward to seeing this more vividly as we go through this year. But I want to leave us with a challenge. The challenge is not to be overcome by the daunting nature of this partnership. Again, we go back to that consideration. How can little man be partnered with big God? How can we be in this relationship? It's through the power of Christ. It's through his life that we have strength. And Satan wants so bad for us to look at a world fallen and look at a world and say there's no hope of ever filling it with his image. And we might not be able to fill it with his image, but we can fill our families. We can fill our friendships. We can fill our churches. We can try our best to fill our communities with his image. with his good. And so for today, let's examine our lives. Am I in this relationship with God today through Christ? Have I entered into this partnership with him? And if so, am I in need of renewing that commitment? Am I in need of getting back to the business that I am in with God, of filling his world with his good image? If so, then let's talk about that. Whether it be commenting on this video or reaching out to us, you can call myself or you can call the elders. What can we do to reignite that desire to work with God in his kingdom, spreading his image through the world in our lives? Whatever it is we can do to assist you in that, we hope that you'll reach out to us. And we thank you so much for your kind attention. Thank you.